For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
Okay, let's learn. All right, so we start the book of Bamidbar this week. One of the essential features of this parsha we're going to find is the count of the Jewish people. And with the maral that I'd like to learn with you today, which is a magnificent maral which will impact many of our daily life attitude, as we've seen a lot of the marals do, have to do with the end, very end of the count. So Torah describes, after going through all of the different tribes and all of the different numbers, Torah then seems to focus on the children of Aharon himself, Moshe's brother. But when the Torah focuses on Aharon, Moshe's brother, it introduces it in the following way. In the beginning of Perek Gimel, Pasuk Alfe, Eila toldos Aharon u'Moshe. These are the generations, the children, the progeny of Aharon and Moshe. So the opening phrase of the Perek tells us that the Torah is now going to tell us who the children of Aharon and Moshe are. Biyom diber Hashem es Moshe b'Har Sinai. On the day, these are their children, when Hashem spoke to Moshe on Har Sinai. So Moshe is up on Har Sinai. On that day, that Moshe is given the Torah. And now we're going to be given the list of the progeny. What children did they have on that day that Hashem spoke to Moshe? The Torah tells us, Eilash Mos b'nei Aharon. Here are the children of Aharon. Habachor, the eldest, was Nadav, and then Avihu, Elazar, and Itamar, the four sons of Aharon. And then the Torah goes on to teach us the Shmos of Bnei Aharon, Hakohen HaMeshuchim, and Nadav and Avihu died. And then the Torah goes on to lots of other things. And Rashi notes, as all the Mefarshim do, there's a little bit of an oddity, because the opening line told us that we're going to tell us the children of both Aharon and Moshe, and yet what we find is only a list of the children of Aharon. We don't find Moshe's children listed here at all. So that the opening line really should have been, Eile toldos Aharon. These are the children of Aharon. Why is Moshe's name added there? So Rashi comments as follows. Rashi comments in Pasuk Aleph, Ve'enu mazkir elo b'nei Aharon. But the Torah only tells us the children of Aharon. Why do we introduce them as being the children of both Aharon and Moshe? Says Rashi, V'nikru told us Moshe. They're still called, even though they're only children of Aharon, they're called the generations, the children of Moshe, the Fishalomdan Torah, because Moshe taught them Torah. Melamed, and this teaches us, Shekola Melamed es ben chavero Torah, anyone who teaches his friend's son Torah, the Torah considers it as if you gave birth to that child. Where do you see that? Because here Moshe is listed as the father of Aharon's children. They're not his children, they're Aharon's children. Why is Moshe listed as the father of Aharon's children? Because Moshe taught them Torah. Since Moshe taught them Torah, anyone, we learn from here, says Rashi, anyone who teaches someone else's children's Torah, someone else's children, Torah is considered as if he himself gave birth to those children. Rashi, the next Rashi says, why does the Pasuk add that it was on the day that Moshe went up to Har Sinai? Rashi says, Nasu Elo HaToldosh, because it was on that day that Moshe became their father, so to speak. Because he taught them what he had learned up on Har Sinai. It was on the day that he went up on Har Sinai, so Maral points out, meaning even on that one day, even just from learning one day's worth of Torah to your friend's children, you're considered as if you gave birth to them. Fine, that's Rashi's lesson. It's a beautiful lesson that all the Rebbeim in the schools, those who teach, rabbis in the shuls, those who teach anyone in their community, in their classrooms, they teach the Torah, it's considered as if you have given birth to that child. Beautiful. We could say it on a spiritual level in the same way as on a physical level. A parent, what do parents provide? Parents provide the physical component of the child. They provide the genetic DNA. They provide the physical body. They give birth to the child. Mother carries the child. So you're the parents. So if I teach you Torah, so in the same way as the parents provided all of this physical sustenance and nourishment to bring a child into the world, so a Rebbe who teaches the child Torah is now providing the spiritual nourishment and sustenance for that child, and to give him everything that he'll need, not just for this world, but for the next world, and therefore you're also considered as if you gave birth. Very nice. Beautiful idea. The problem that we're going to discuss today is, what do we refer to Moshe as? What do we call him? Moshe Rabbeinu. What does it mean, Moshe Rabbeinu? He's our rabbi. He's our rabbi. Moshe taught everyone Torah. So here the pasuk seems to be saying something. Who did Moshe also father? Who is he also considered a father of? Aharon's children. Why is he considered a father of Aharon's children? Because he taught them Torah. Moshe taught everybody Torah. Moshe was the Melamed Shel Kol Yisrael. He was our go-between from Har Sinai, where he learned everything himself. He taught all of Klal Yisrael Torah. So why don't we say, on every single time we ever list anyone's children, like we do here for Aharon's children, everywhere in the Chumash, when you list anyone's children, you should call them Eila Toldos, B'nai Reuven, and Moshe. Because Moshe's, they're also his children. Why are you only listing the sons, just like by Aharon? Everybody should know it. That's a very simple question. Hear the question? The answer is beautiful. It says the Maral as follows. Let's read it inside. I am going to pick up from the reading, if you want to follow me inside, the very last line of this page, the Imtoma, the second to last line of the Maral over there. You can just listen in. If you don't want to follow inside, either way, it's good with me. The Imtoma, and if you'll say, V'chi v'hem levad limad, are these the only people that Moshe taught? Halo l'cho Yisrael limad. The Yuakol told Yosef, everybody should be considered offspring of Moshe, because he taught everybody. And says the Maral as follows, V'yei Shalom, could say as follows, Dishani Yisrael. No, when Moshe taught the Jewish people, it's fundamentally different than when he taught his nephews, the sons of Aaron. Sharei HaKadosh Baruch Hu Tzivolo Shilamid Lahem Torah. Because to the rest of the Jewish people, Hashem commanded Moshe and said, your job is teach everyone the Torah that I just gave you. That was a tzivoy. It was a commandment from Hashem. Moshe is now obligated. He has a job to do, and his job is to teach Torah. The HaTorah shenitna leMoshe. Not only did he have a job of a commandment to do it, but that the Torah that he received lo nitna elo lelamid liYisrael Torah. The only reason why Moshe received the Torah himself is in order to be able to give it over to the Jewish people. Moshe didn't merit on his own that he should be given this tremendous gift of Torah. It wasn't his to have. It was his to have to teach to the Jewish people. We've seen them all similar to this, that Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, none of them received the Torah. Not Avraham, they knew it. Chazal say they learned it. But none of them received the Torah. Why? Because they're individuals. It's just Avraham. And then it's just Yitzchak, and then it's Yaakov. Not until Yaakov has 12 children does the Jewish people begin to form, but it's not until those 12 expand into a nation that now we have a klal. Now we have a people. The Torah is given to klal Yisrael, it's not given to an individual. The only reason why it was given to Moshe was specifically that he should go and teach. Therefore, says the Maral, Lo Shayach Lomar Shi Yisrael Heim Banav. You can't then say that the Jewish people are his children because he taught them and gave them their life. Because She'el Mole Lo Hayu Yisrael, because had there not been a Jewish people, Lo Hayu Torah Nitna LaMoshe, there wouldn't be a Torah given to Moshe. What's the order that it goes? When you speak about a father-son relationship, the Maral speaks out. What's the relationship? Who's responsible for whom? Because of whom does who exist? So it's always, by definition, because of the parents, the children exist. There wouldn't be for parents, there wouldn't be children. That's the relationship of Ki'ilu Yolda. That's the relationship of, I've given birth to this child, you exist because of me. Says the Maral, well, what's the relationship between Moshe and the Jewish people? It's the opposite. Moshe exists because of them. The Jewish leader, you've been elevated to your level of leadership and of greatness because you have to lead the people. I'm only giving you this Torah because you have to teach it to them. If there wouldn't be a Jewish people, I'm not giving it to you. You're just an individual. So who created who? Says Maral. It's almost as if you would say the Jewish people created Moshe. So you can't say this lesson of anyone who teaches his friend's children Torah is considered as if he gave birth to them. That's not true if you were forced into teaching that child. Moshe was forced into teaching the Jewish people Torah because he was only given it in order to teach it to them. And that kind of relationship does not net this idea of it's as if you have given birth to this child. Why is it different than his nephews? Says Maral, Avol Mashalim Levnei Aharon Yoser Mimashalim Ali Yisrael. His nephews he taught more than the rest of the Jewish people. When he would come home at night, after a long day of work, of teaching the Jewish people Torah, and answering their questions, and being their judge, and taking care of everything, then when he would find time in his off hours to teach his nephews a little bit more, Zehoyo Mimoshe Levad. Where did that come from? Where was the inspiration to find the time to teach his own children or his nephews some extra Torah? Where did that come from? That's him. It wasn't because he was commanded to. It wasn't because he had a job to. It wasn't because the only reason why he existed was to do so. It's because he wanted to. They're his nephews. So lo nitzav mipiyad, for he wasn't commanded. Bazeh ki'ilu yaldam. And that, when you, on your own initiative, on your own ratzon, your own desire, because you want to teach someone else, on that, the sages say, we learn from here, you gave birth to that child. Just like their parents gave birth to their physical being, you've just given birth to their spiritual being. But if you had to do it, if you only existed to be able to do so, so then we don't say such a concept of it as if you've given birth to that child, just the opposite. They are the cause of your existence. You only have what you have in order to be able to provide it for them, and therefore we don't say such an idea. That, says the Maral, is the explanation as to why we see only in the relationship between Moshe and his nephews. There and there alone do the sages derive this principle of it as if you gave birth to them, but we don't find that by any of the other children of the Jewish people, because their Moshe was required to do so. Very nice, beautiful idea. Let me add what the Maral points out in points out in footnote number 6 on the bottom of the left-hand side of the page. This is where this applies in other areas of life as well. He says as follows, Mevuar midvar, what comes out from the Maral's language, ki tzivui, the concept of being commanded to do something, uki'ilu yaldu, and as if I've given birth to someone, are omdim zel umozos. They stand on opposite sides of the spectrum. In order for me to be able to say I've given birth to something, it has to be that I wanted it. That I, on my own, came to the conclusion, the ideal, and made it happen. But as soon as I have a task, I have a commandment, and I'm forced to doing it, then we would never apply that concept of, I birthed this. Not if you're forced to. The kol heicha shenimsa tzivoy bedavar, anytime you find that idea of you have to, mimela yesh kan hafka, what you have by definition is a removal from ki'ilu yoldu. It's not yours. You didn't give birth to it. You had to. Those two things are opposite sides of the spectrum. Why, says Rav Harman explaining this Maharal, ki kol tzivoy omed me etzem gidro l'umas raton. What does it mean to say that you're commanded on something? What does it mean when you say, I have to? The phrase, I have to. I have to get this done. We use that phrase all the time. We use it in terms of work. I have to stay late tonight. I have to get this report in. I have to return this phone call. Or I have to go to shul. I have to... What is it? What do the words express? I don't want to. This is against my will. There is some force acting upon me that's getting me to do this. It could be my paycheck. It could be a boss. Could be whatever it is. Fear, it doesn't matter. There is something that is driving you, and it is not you that's driving you. Because if it were you, I wouldn't be doing this. I don't want to be out late. I want to be home with my family. I don't want to be working on this project. I really enjoy working on those kinds of projects. But I have to. So as soon as you're into the realm of have to, by definition, you're out of the realm of my ratzon, my inner yearnings, desires, wants, because you're saying, I don't really want this. There's something else that's forcing me to do it. This is what the man writes. Either kol tzavahu kechiyu v'chazhara. Anytime you're commanded, it's something that you're forced into doing. V'loshon zeh mochiach ki lo limad Moshe liyisrael v'nei shehatov mashpia lezulaso. Which now means Moshe teaches all of the Jewish people. He's teaching them Torah. Why? Why is Moshe teaching all of Chal Yisrael Torah? You can't say, says the Maharal, that it's coming out of an inner desire to benefit people around you. That's godliness. Godliness is, on the essence, God is, as much as we can say these words, the essence of goodness, who has a desire to bestow goodness upon others. However clumsy those words sound in referring to God, but that basic idea. That's not what Moshe was doing. Moshe was not expressing a godliness, says the Maharal, in teaching the Jewish people Torah. He may have wanted to do that, but we'll never really know. Because he only existed to do so. There was something which comes before that, in which Hashem says to him, you only received this gift for one purpose and one purpose only. Get it to them. You're my conduit. You're up here with me alone on Har Sinai for only one reason. It's not because I'm here to teach you Torah and then the two of us are to hang out together. It's because you have a job to do. You have to teach those people Torah. So when Moshe comes down and teaches, so you can't say it's from a place of godliness, of this is my desire to share with what I have. I have to. I only exist for this. Now, that was his role, and that's what he did. He was, I say like this is a big negative, he was the conduit between God and the Jewish people. But what that means he wasn't his own ratzon. That's what that means, that he wasn't. In order for him to be successful, that's the relationship that had to have been. It had to be pure, it had to be exact, and it has to be unadulterated from God to us through somebody. How does God communicate with people? So with the Navi, yes, but to all the people, no, it doesn't work that way. So he was a conduit, and he was just a perfect reflection, just straight through him. But that means it wasn't then through him, and then I want to do this, it was I have to do this. Except for his nephews. For his nephews was, I don't have to do that. You're like everybody else in the have to, but now let's go over it a little bit more. And that changed the entire dynamic. Now you've given birth to those children, not to everybody else, to those boys, those children, those nephews of yours. They're yours. Says Maral, v'halocha ravachasi she'ein ish yochol lohoi lebal korchach rachbam. So you can only give birth to somebody through your own desire. Says Rav Hartman, explain around, this is an idea that the Maral points out in numerous, we spoke about this once if you remember, about the tremendous tension that exists. This is getting ready for Shavuos on Kabbalah Satorah of Nasev and Nishma, we want it, and we have to. If you remember, that was a whole piece that the Maral discussed about how every day of our life is really a tension between two feelings. One of, I'm a fish out of water without Torah. I can't live without it. I have to have it. But if I only have that sensation, then I don't relate to it. It's not mine. I don't want it. I'm not interested. I'm going to die without it. On the other hand, you have, that's the sensation of the mountain being held over our heads. And on the other hand, it's Nasa V'Nishma. It's on our own. We said, we want it. I don't care what's in it. I want it. But if you only have that, so then you have the idea of, it's really up to me. I'm the one who decides that Torah is good. But that doesn't work either. And they both exist at the same time in an absolutely impossible dichotomy of, I have no choice, I cannot live without this, but I'm doing it because I'm choosing it and I want it. And they coexist in an impossible way. Because they both are simultaneously true. If you only live because you think, I have to do this, so you're missing your soul isn't attached to it. It's not living through your body. You're not living a life of Torah because it's heim kiheim chayin of yorachamein. It's everything. It's because you feel you're going to die otherwise. So we approach things that we're going to do because we're going to die You know, it's a way, it's a certain way of life. But that's not the way of life we want. I want a life because this is the best thing ever. But you can't think that it's only because you decided it's the best thing ever. They both coexist. Says Morel, because anything that you're forced, and this is another application of that, it's against your will by definition. What does it mean against your will? I don't want this. I don't want it. Anything that you don't want is not an expression of your deepest innermost desires. Someone else is forcing it out of you. And that is not as if you gave birth to something. And one last Shavuos element that he brings in over here, and that's why the Moral explains there's a concept that a Gershon is Geyer is Kekotan Shinola Dami. When a non-Jew converts, he's viewed as a child, as if he's starting fresh. He has no relationships with anybody. And the Moral explains why that concept did not apply when the Jewish people converted, so to speak, at Har Sinai. When they accepted the Torah, they maintained their relationships. They didn't have any of that halachic principle. And he explains because of this idea that there was a mountain hanging over their head, and therefore the conversion at Har Sinai was a fundamentally different type of conversion than every other convert in history. Every other convert in history comes forth on their own and says, I want this. And the Jewish people, who were the fulfillment of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov in 210 years, they didn't have a choice in the matter. As soon as you don't have a choice in the matter, there's a different type of concept. And lastly, without bringing specific examples, but he speaks about this elsewhere, there's no, and this is really the concept that we need to take into our lives regularly. The Moral writes, there's no such concept of simcha when there's hechrech, when there's something being forced upon you. You cannot do something with joy, cannot do something with a smile, cannot do it with happiness, if you feel you're being forced. Noral writes it as a philosophical impossibility because of this idea. Because if I have to get this project done, if I have to stay late, I have to make this phone call, it's not me who wants this. There's a force imposing itself upon me. Where does joy come from? So the joy, the simcha has to come from within. It has to come from my own ratzon, my own fulfillment of my own innermost yearnings and desires. And I feel myself working towards fulfillment. Sometimes that's hard. It's hard work, but there could be joy in that if you feel like you're accomplishing what you want to do. But if you feel you're being forced into something, that's not me. Someone else is forcing my desires. Cannot have joy when you're doing that. Just doesn't work. You can have joy while you're working hard. If you're the one who wants to get the project done, and you set that as your goal, and now you say, I have to get this done, so then you can have joy. You set that agenda. But if somebody else set that agenda, whether it be a boss, paycheck, fear, whatever it may be, there's no joy in that, because it's not me anymore. It's not an expression of who I am. It's I'm being forced into something by someone else or some other force outside of me, and there can't be joy in that. And this, again, brings us back to the dichotomy that a Jew lives every single day of his life with. Ivdu es Hashem b'simcha, we're required to serve Hashem with joy, to feel the privilege that we have to be Jewish, to be able to serve Hashem, and at the same time, we recognize there's an eye, as the Mishnah Pirkei Avos says, there's an eye that's watching you, there's an ear that hears everything, everything you do is written in a book, you're going to give a judgment on it. It's like, I have to do this. Well, how am I supposed to do this with joy? How is there an Ivdu es Hashem b'simcha when you tell me that everything I do is being recorded and there's going to be a judgment and I'm going to be held accountable for everything? I have to. That's the dichotomy. That's literally the tension that exists in the religious Jew's life of the greatest joy is to be a Jew, and there's no other option. There's no choice. It's the way that it has to be. But if there's no choice, that's how we live. It's literally, you know, being a Jew is complex. Being a Jew is complex, and this is part of that complexity, which is all brought out from the fact that Moshe is only considered a father to Aaron's children, because only to Aaron's children was it an expression of himself and his desire. The rest of the Jewish people was something that he absolutely had to do, and therefore was the one who did it. Okay, quick Dvar Halacha. So there's a halacha on Shabbos that you're not allowed to do business. The reason for that is because of a fear that if you do business, even if you don't actually exchange money, that you'll come to write things down, because that's since I gave you something, you know, I'm going to write it down. And since writing is one of the primary prohibitions, one of the malachas of Shabbos, so we don't write, you can't do business on Shabbos. Even if it's for the purpose of a mitzvah, let's say a person doesn't have lulav on Sukkot, you can't buy a lulav on Sukkot, you can't buy a shofar on Rosh Hashanah. You can't have a transaction in which something actually transfers hands, lest you come to write something down. Parenthetically, you can talk about it if it's for a mitzvah purpose, and you're not actually, there's no good that's being transferred, like you're buying an aliyah, or you're buying the right to daven for the Alma. There are certain things with the, which is in this in-between category of it's for a mitzvah purpose, but there's no actual goods that are transferring. It's just I'm committing to tzedakah. That gets into a separate issue, but not relevant to us. Included in the prohibition of giving a gift, of doing business, is giving a gift. You can't give a gift on Shabbos in which you're going to actually transfer goods from one person's possessions to another person's possessions, because it gets included in the category of business dealings in which there's a transfer of goods and a fear that something is going to be written down. There's an important exception to that, which we utilize almost every single week, and that is if the gift that's being given is considered Sorech Shabbos, the need of Shabbos, or can be used on Shabbos. So then, it's not included in the prohibition of giving the gift, because it is actually a mitzvah need for the present Shabbos, and therefore you're allowed to give it. So in general, so let's say you're going to someone's house, and it was the child's birthday recently, and you missed their birthday, and you want to bring them a gift, but the gift is either it's not going to be opened on Shabbos, or there's no relevance to Shabbos, or it's a mukzah on Shabbos. So you can't give them a gift on Shabbos, because you don't give gifts, even though it's only a gift, it's not actual business dealings, you don't give gifts on Shabbos. But if what you're giving is a tzorech of Shabbos, for example, and if the gift you're going to give them, they would actually be able to use. Many gifts cannot be used on Shabbos because they either need to be put together or they're mukzah or whatever. But if it's something they can use, then that'll be fine. For example, like a bottle of wine. Bottle of wine is your classic example in which I'm bringing you a gift. Why am I allowed to bring you a gift on Shabbos? Because the tzorech of Shabbos. Even if you don't plan on using it this particular Shabbos, it is a need for Shabbos. And you could choose to use it or you could choose not to use it, but it's something which is usable on Shabbos, and therefore I can give it as a gift. There happens to be another parenthetical way around that, in that I might not actually be giving it to you as a gift. I'm just bringing it for myself and I'm letting you share. But usually it's not done that way. You actually do give it to your host as a gift. They can choose to do with it what you want. If you were to just sort of put it on the table, and then you're not even transferring the possession, but usually it's not done that way. I bring you candy, I bring you wine, I hand it to you, thank you so much for having us, I'm giving you a gift. Why am I allowed to do that? We don't give gifts on Shabbos. The answer is, because what I'm giving you is readily usable on Shabbos, whether you choose to serve it or not. Generally the host does, but certainly they can at any moment choose to do so, and it becomes therefore a tzorech Shabbos, and you have to do so. I mention this because it's worth noting that therefore what one should not do is give a candy dish or other things which would need to be toveled or are simply not a picture frame. Certain things are not ready to be used, and you have a much more difficult time saying that the tzorech of Shabbos. I give you a picture frame, you want to bring it over on Friday afternoon, drop it off, that's wonderful, it's a lovely gift, and I'm sure your host will appreciate it. But that there are a gift such as cannot easily fit into what we would call a tzorech of Shabbos, some type of Shabbos need, really should not be given on Shabbos, and therefore the types of gifts, which is why traditionally people bring dessert, wine, things like that, because that's absolutely okay. Once you get out of the food realm, it gets a lot more tricky whether or not you can bring such a gift. Certainly if the gift that you're bringing isn't ready to be used. It needs things which either can't be done on Shabbos or has no bearing on Shabbos, have a picture frame or a dish that needs to be toveled. So those kinds of things really should not be brought on Shabbos. Yeah.
What happens if, like, you bring candy on top of the dish that, needs to be toveled?
Right.
Like a dessert that's,
on the plate, and you're planning on leaving them with the, it's already been toveled, that's why the candy's in it?
Or like it hasn't been toveled, but it's kind of comes with the package.
The whole thing?
Yeah,
so in that scenario, correct me if I'm wrong, the question is what are you giving? Are you giving candy or are you giving a dish? Meaning to say, there are some types of, like when you bought it, there's the primary and the second. Are you giving Is it the kind of dish, I'll say it like this, is it the kind of dish that if you were to say to yourself back home, I like this candy, and you would dump out the candy and just give them the gift, the dish, that it's the type of quality that makes sense to give as a hostess gift?
Like, honest to people, like, that's their gift to their hostess, is that they give the candy with the dish.
Right. No, no, so what I mean to say is, in other words, if you were to take the candy out, is the dish something that's an actual gift, or is it it's just part of the candy? So if it is an actual gift, but I just wonder if it's thrown it together as a package. It's an interesting thing. It's probably okay because it's part of the whole thing. Probably okay because of that. That'd be my guess. No, it's because you're using it. As it is, you're using it. Just but those, you know, standalone, you know, nice boxed things that you can't even use this today. So then that I would have. Technically, you could probably get it. I could say you could use it. You'll put, you know, only things with wrappers on it so the food doesn't actually touch it. Just think that gets into a more difficult area to say, like, this is the Tzaruch of Shabbos. I don't know. It's hard to say that. But maybe you can. Yeah?
Is there, I thought I read, but I don't actually know how to do this. Isn't there a way to transfer ownership before Shabbos to that?
Yeah, if you needed to, if you had anybody else outside of your own husband could accept the gift on behalf of your hostess.
And then you just bring it to them.
Correct. So in other words, there's a principle in halacha that says, the halachic principle is called Zachin La'adam Shalo Befanav. You can do something that's considered a merit or a good thing for somebody without their knowledge. So that if I find $100 on the street, if I find an iPod, I'm saying, I don't need one, but I know that you need one. So I can pick this up and say, I'm picking this up for the Solomons. And who owns it now? You actually own it. Because I served as your agent, and even though you didn't appoint me to be your agent, because what I'm about to do is intrinsically good for you, so the halacha recognizes I can appoint myself your agent without your having appointed me to do so. I do it myself for you because it's good for you. You can retroactively either deny it if it's, but assuming that it's an intrinsically good thing. So you're doing that here also. And you could find somebody else and say, can you please acquire this for my hostess? I'd like to bring it to them tomorrow.
And that it looks like it's even okay.
Yeah, it's totally fine. Your husband can't do it because it's not transferring owner. You and he are the same halachically as far as that goes. So it needs to somebody else needs to acquire it from you. And that therefore you would need somebody else.
You can do that before Shabbos.
Correct.
And two
you can do that.
Are you allowed to, I don't know if this is just a very video of a thing or if it's really okay, even the chachila. I've heard sometimes if someone gives you a gift and it's not food, that you can just keep in mind I'm not going to.
You're not accepting
them.
It, yeah.
Now, is that the kind of thing you're supposed to try to do only video of it? Or like, can you, the chachila, give someone a gift like this and just say to them,
yeah,
keep this in mind that it's not yours until after Shabbos?
Yeah, I would avoid it. There's no reason to do so unless, you know, but.
So you should avoid that.
I know, I wouldn't bring a gift to someone and say,
Don't accept it.
You know, tell them, I'm going to bring it over after Shabbos. I forgot to bring it to you. What I want to give you is really nothing related to Shabbos.
You should rely on that if someone's brought you the gift. You don't
if someone brings it to you, you should say, I'm not having in mind to accept this right now.
And lastly, with this thing with the food, do they have to, do you or they, or the hostess, do you have to try to use it on
No, I don't think you have to use it. No, because the food item is intrinsically a tzorach of Shabbos. And therefore, whether you use it, you don't use it, that they're allowed to give it to you because it is. You could decide not to use it, but it is intrinsically a Shabbos item. All right, enjoy.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. For those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.